Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk as part of the Glasgow School of Social Work Research Seminar Series. This talk was recorded on the 31st of January 2011. Robin Sen Lecture at Sheffield University and Dr. Pam Green Lister Lecture at Glasgow School of Social Work.
In terms of what we did for this project, it was a literature review. In 2004, HMIE, Her Majesty's Inspector of Education, took over a new multidisciplinary inspection regime looking and inspecting child protection services. And their first cycle of inspections was between 2006 and 2009. Second cycle is currently ongoing. And in 2007, the new Scottish Government introduced a new national performance framework with 45 national indicators. And one of them was to improve the number of local authorities getting positive child protection inspection results. And so this piece of research was commissioned to look at research evidence that would help improve child protection practice and in so doing help local authorities meet the national indicator that's been set. In terms of the research that we looked at, we looked primarily at primary studies from 2000 on, based either in Scotland or in the UK with clear relevance to a Scottish context. We generally excluded literature before 2000 and international research literature, unless it was regarded as seminal, that's to say it was cited frequently in the literature after 2000, or if there was a lack of UK-based evidence, we did include some international evidence in those cases. We also included inquiry reports and assessments, analyses of inquiry reports, which were a major source of evidence for the review. And the review that we undertook also included policy and some expert opinion pieces, though the focus was on primary studies. So it was a narrative review rather than a systematic review in that we didn't grade the primary studies according to a hierarchy of evidence, but we did adopt some of the techniques of a systematic review in that we rated studies on a scale of 1 to 3, 1 being the best, 3 the worst, for both relevance and methodological rigour. And we generally didn't include studies that scored a 3 either for methodology or for relevance. We also included grey literature, that's to say literature that isn't generally published in hard copy form. So we accessed websites of relevant organisations for research that they had conducted and published on their websites. And we also wrote to all 30 child protection committees in Scotland, asking them for any research that they'd commissioned which wasn't published, and a number of them responded. In addition to the desktop work, we also conducted key informant interviews with people who had particular knowledge about the inspection process or about child protection in Scotland. And they gave us feedback on the emerging themes from the literature and other areas that they thought we needed to explore. And we also had an advisory group that met at the beginning, middle and end of the research to help steer it. One of the key documents for us starting out was HMIE's report, How Well Do We Protect Scotland's Children, which was their report after the first cycle of inspections between 2006 and 2009, which highlighted areas of strength, weakness, and national areas for development. And we looked at that report and looked at the areas that they'd identified and then looked for research evidence around those areas. Just in terms of acknowledgements, first of all, we'd like to acknowledge IRIS, the Institute for Research and Innovation in Social Services, who funded the research, and its director, Alison Petch, who provided guidance on the research itself, and also, latterly, very welcomely, provided some leverage in terms of the final deadline for our report. The final report will be published both in an executive summary and the full report in February, we hope, on the IRIS website. In terms of the key informant interviews, I just want to mention them briefly by name to acknowledge their contribution, which is very valuable. They were Neil McKechnie, who is the Chief Inspector of HMIE, Colin McCaraca and Brian Newell, who are respectively Chief Constable of Grampian Police Force and Detective Superintendent at Grampian Police Force, Corinne Begg, who's the Lead Officer for North East of Scotland Child Protection Committee, Beth Smith, who's the Director of the Multi-Agency Resource Services for Child Protection, MARS, which is based at Stirling University, Melanie DeRose, who's a Quality Assurance and Development Officer at Fife Child Protection Committee, Penny Rowe, the Development Officer at Highland Child and Adult Protection Committee, and Ross Drummond, who's Child Protection Interagency Coordinator at Perth and Kinross Council. Also, in our terms of our research advisory group, Professor Alison Petch from IRIS was on it. Also like to acknowledge the contribution of Martin Kettle, who's a lecturer at Glasgow Caledonian in social work, Sheena Morrison, who's the head of social work services south at Glasgow City Council, and Professor Joe Norm, who's ex-head of school here. So thanks to all of them for their contribution, which is really valuable. The usual disclaimer applies in that any gaps in the research are our own and not theirs. In terms of the policy context, one of the things that is relevant to note is there's been a huge amount of changing policy within the area of child protection and children, families and social work. And one of the things that means is it's sometimes quite hard to keep up, and it also reflects the fact that child protection is an area of public debate and concern and for political intervention. And it reflects the fact that I think that for those working in child protection services, those receiving them, and those governing child protection services in the UK, that child protection is not working as well as it might. In addition to the Scottish context, at the moment, there's two significant reviews going on a UK or an English-wide basis. So the Social Work Task Force was set up on the back of what happened in the Peter Connolly case and looked at the management of frontline practice, and has led to the development of the National College. The exact remit of that college, and indeed its name, has yet to be finalised, but there is an idea that that will provide leadership and direction on frontline practice. To add into that mix, the new coalition government in the UK introduced and announced a review of child protection in England, the Munro Review, to be led by Eileen Munro, which reports in April. And even though that is only based in England, it's relevant to know it might have some relevance to a Scottish context. So some of the things that have been spoken about around the amount of time that social workers are spending doing bureaucracy and administration as opposed to frontline practice. And there's been some discussion of the Hackney model, which is a model of consultant social workers in Hackney who are paid around a management level but undertake frontline roles and responsibilities as part of a multidisciplinary team, including clinical therapists and clinical practitioners, and also have strong admin support to free them up to do frontline practice. In terms of the Scottish context, I'll deal with this as briefly as I can, but just to acknowledge it, it's everyone's job to make sure I'm all right, was an audit of child protection practice in Scotland, and it highlighted some key gaps in practice, primarily that children who had service input from a range of professionals over a period of time still remained at risk of significant harm. And secondly, that there was a lack of public confidence and faith in the child protection system and a lack of confidence in those who receive child protection services. As a result, it led to a reform programme, the Child Protection Reform Programme, which had a number of strands, the most relevant of which were the introduction of HMIE as the body responsible for inspections in Scotland of child protection services. It also introduced a children's charter, which was a series of things that children wanted from child protection services that were reformatted into a framework of 8 principles for child protection practitioners. A further recommendation of It's Everyone's Job was that there should be a single assessment and intervention framework for practitioners, and that was put into practice through GIRFEC, Getting It Right for Every Child, which I'm sure everyone in the room has heard about, which was an introduction of a single assessment and intervention framework for all childcare professionals assessing and trying to meet the needs of children in Scotland. And finally, just want to acknowledge at the end of last year, there was a revised national guidance on child protection, which replaced the 1998 child protection guidance. A number of strands to it, but the one that I'll highlight just now is around working with children on the child protection register. It introduces a new timescale of 21 days for holding child protection case conferences, and also removes the requirement for local authorities to identify a category of registration, so a child being registered category of neglect, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and so on. Presumably the underlying notion behind that is that in the most complex cases, many of the issues overlap, and it's more important to get a holistic view of the risks and the needs of the children in those cases rather than identifying a particular category of registration. So in terms of the presentation, There's five areas. The actual final report has 13 sections to it, and even if we wanted to speak to them, we didn't know that everyone would want to listen to all 13 of them in the time we had available. So we've chosen five. We thought that were the, firstly, some of the most relevant for frontline practice and frontline practitioners, but we also chose them because they give some indication of issues along the continuum of care. So when children are with their parents at risk, through to where there may have been substantiated evidence of abuse, through to where they're in substitute placements. So Pam will speak to the first two on assessment and information sharing and recording, and I'll speak to the latter three on involving children in child protection practice, working with families where they may have experienced significant harm, and best practice in kinship care.
What I'm going to do, I've got four slides here, two on assessment and two on information sharing and recording, and one slide in each looks at the principal research findings, and the second tries to pull out areas for good practice. In terms of the findings from the empirical research studies that we looked at in terms of assessment, there were some very clear messages that emerged. What we found was that less specific referrals were tended to receive less priority with regard to social work and police and indeed health response. So, for example, if a child had presented with a physical injury, very often that was, mostly that was responded to very, very quickly. But in areas such as emotional abuse and neglect, it was likely that there was less immediate response, and perhaps those referrals were given less priority. The biennial analyses of serious case reviews in England and also the Ofsted reports in England show that very well. So what we tend to have in terms of assessment is that cases where there might be ongoing concerns about a child being neglected, but not in the position where the child perhaps should be looked after and accommodated, there tends to be a situation where what Brandon et al. In terms of serious case reviews call the start again syndrome. That is that if the parents appear to be presenting as trying to do better, significant events like a new baby being born, ironically, or the parents suddenly appearing to be responsive to services, then those concerns about the child tend to be lessened. There's a real issue about failing to take into account past history. And it's obvious, we know in child abuse that the likelihood of abuse is greater if there's been abuse in the past. But what we found looking at the empirical studies and what the biennial analyses found was that there's a situation in which that, A, people don't read files, and B, it appears that there seems to be an issue in terms of supervision of workers where a person, a supervisor, a principal officer who has an overview of the case isn't looking at the previous history of the family, and past history isn't taken into account. Robin and I have been looking at files in another context, and when you actually have a file in front of you and you read through and you see the patterns of behaviour, it seems very clear in retrospect that a worker should have taken into account what had happened in the past. But what we found in our empirical reviews of the empirical research was that wasn't taken into account. Failures of communication, I'm going to look at more of that in information sharing and recording. But even now there is an issue in terms of failures with regard to communication. And there are several aspects to that. Sometimes it's just that actually people don't communicate and don't tell each other and assume that a person knows what they know. So sometimes it's actual non-communication. But sometimes it's about communication being given and not affirmed. So you might get a referral, for example, from a health visitor to social work. Social work hasn't affirmed that they've received that referral. The health visitor assumes that action's been taken and doesn't follow that up, and vice versa. So the failures of communication, there are a number of areas to that which I'll look at in the next section. There's a real issue about failure to engage directly with children. When you look at the empirical studies and when you look at case files, what you see is that there's a real energy of social workers in particular to engage with parents, to bring parents on board, to make sure that they're alongside parents. And when you look at the amount of times that social workers actually visit the child, see the child, talk to the child, they're very few. And very often what you get in child protection cases, and I'm sure those of you who work in childcare will realise that, is that child protection cases, often what you're doing is you're going out and meeting with parents and you're not actually meeting with children. There's a real lack of attention to male partners. Ofsted report was very clear about that, as was Brandon et al. In their serious case reviews in England. And the situation, obviously, is the same in cases like Caleb Ness in Scotland. It appears that what social workers tend to do, from what we've seen from the empirical research, is they engage with parents, yes, but mainly with the mother. And what they're not taking into account are male partners. And the majority of cases that we've seen in terms of child deaths and serious child injury have in fact been committed by a male partner, either the father of the child or a male who is inhabiting the house or a friend. Individuals of reasoning in complex cases, this could be a seminar in itself. Eileen Munro talks a lot about that in her 1999 work and subsequent work. And it feels, you know, as a person now who's an academic and not doing frontline work, it feels quite difficult to talk about that, because I'm aware in my past I had individual errors in terms of complex cases. I found out afterwards the issues that I totally missed when I was a social worker and a senior social worker. But I think what the point I want to make there is the issue about supervision. I think that social workers and health visitors in particular, in terms of their supervision, it's essential that there is someone with an overview of the case and who's able to critically question, be a critical friend in terms of what's happening as a social worker is trying to work in very complex cases where parents are not engaging, where parents might be putting up smoke screens, or where parents might be actually genuinely confused about what they should do. And I think it's really important to help a social worker in those complex cases to reason through that. There's also issues in terms of systemic and structural context, and those of you who will have read Lord Lamming's review of Victoria Clambier will be aware that whilst there are individual errors of reasoning and individual concerns about individual social workers, in terms of staffing, in terms of support, what we have, particularly with social work and police in the Victoria Clambier situation, is that staff were not given the resources with which to be able to properly engage with families. That includes a range of areas like supervision, like office space, people being able to take their holidays, having supervision, being able to actually find a meeting space. That was one of the issues in the Victoria Clambier inquiry. So what we have here are lots of systemic and structural issues with regard to how you can actually engage in an assessment. And we know in Victoria Clambier, for example, that a particular police force and a particular social work department, personalities, they did not get on. And actually, individual people not getting on left a situation where a child and probably several children were at risk. There's also the issue of roles of assessment tools and procedures, and in child protection, like in other areas, there's been an increasing use of actuarial tools, and some of those have been useful in terms of assisting social workers to understand what's happening in an individual case, thinking about in the context of what we know in terms of the kind of the broader meta-analyses of risks. But there's a problem with the use of these tools and procedures in that, for example, in England, in the Common Assessment Framework, more time and effort has been put into completing the actual online data input, and less time has been given to actually working with individual families. So in terms of supporting good practice, certainly what is needed is more child-focused skills. And I see students here and I see social workers here who will be working with children and families. And I would like to just ask you to think for yourselves how long you spend with an individual child compared to how long you spend with the parents of that child. And very often children are trying to speak to us and we're not engaging directly with children. There's obviously issues in terms of carer-focused skills too, But I have a caveat to that in that from what I've seen in my own research and looking at the empirical research is that the tendency seems to be to try to engage with parents to ensure that they are on board with us and not actually to be child-focused. Interprofessional skills. In our report, in our summary report, we note a study by Sue White and Breege Featherston, who did an empirical ethnographic study of co-located workers in social work and health and mental health. And what they highlighted was that there is an issue with regard to social workers, and I'm speaking to social workers here, who have a certain, perhaps, mindset about themselves and their professional identity and others' identity. They, for example, they talk about social workers often having what's called an atrocity story. So in order for social workers to kind of understand their own beliefs and values, very often that's translated into telling atrocity stories about how other professionals didn't do their job. And I think we have to be really careful as social workers that we don't engage in that and understand what it means to be interprofessional workers. There's an issue of looking at values, power and culture. Again, that's a seminar in itself. I suppose one thing I want to highlight there is that social workers don't have... Often social workers talk about having their own values, and social work values are very important, but what I think is really important is to understand that other professionals too have their values, which they hold dearly, and they also think, in terms of their credibility, understand their professional role in terms of their credibility. I think it's really important that social workers, we don't feel that we have a monopoly, if you like, on values. It's really important to understand that in terms of culture and power. I think Eileen Monroe talks about having an open mind and willingness to question initial assessment. And one of the issues that came out in the empirical research is that, and in the serious case reviews and significant case reviews in Scotland, is that it was very difficult for social work and others, once they'd made a judgment, once they'd made an assessment, to then look back on that assessment in the light of new information and then critically analyse their own judgment. Very often what we found, this was found in Brandon Lee, this was found in Caleb Ness, is that social workers tended to look for information which would validate their initial judgment and actually didn't take into account information which didn't validate their judgment, if you see what I mean. So the information, when you're looking through case notes, when you're looking at the empirical studies, you see that social workers are picking out issues, events which would validate their initial judgment rather than looking at a new event and thinking, actually, that calls into question my initial assessment. In terms of principal research findings with regard to information sharing and recording, I think the key issue here is that, A, yes, people still don't share enough information. There is still an issue, particularly with regard to health, with regard to confidentiality and sharing information with social workers. There's a key fault line, as it's been called in some empirical research, between childcare and adult services, particularly criminal justice services, drug services, and childcare services. So there's still an issue with regard to workers who are working confidentially with adults with regard to their drug and alcohol use, or criminal justice workers not sharing information with childcare workers. And that's also the case in terms of people in health, particularly, for example, being to psychiatric nurses. But probably people do share information more now. We have, you know, case discussions, we've got child protection case conferences, we have core groups. But as Eileen Monroe suggests, that there's an issue now about actually processing that information. So sharing information itself doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And there's a concern that sometimes a problem shared is a problem halved. There's a concern sometimes that the actual shared information tends to allay concerns. So people talk about their concerns, good sharing information, but then what happens is that there doesn't seem to be a processing of that information and acting on that. And Reader and Duncan have this is one of the non-empirical works that we use to look at the psychology of communication, talk about the different ways that we communicate, and they look at the technical, practical and linguistic processes in terms of communicating, that very basically information can be given, you can communicate to someone, the person has to receive that, they have to acknowledge the receipt, and there has to be a mutual acknowledgement of what that, the meaning of that communication. So Reader and Duncan, Child Abuse Review, I would suggest everyone should read that. It's an absolute seminal piece of work. I've talked a bit about confidentiality. In terms of information recording, Robin and I have both done a fair amount of work looking at case files, and it is actually, it's really concerning when you look at how information is recorded. Very often, what I've found in the research I've done, for example, is that I've found that what you have in, for example, in Glasgow, you have your electronic database, you have a written case file. Very often the relationship between the two is difficult. People might put something on the electronic database, they don't put it in their written file. And very often, for example, in Care First in Glasgow, what you have is a very fragmented database about where you record. You record events, you might record chronology. And what we found in our empirical research is that recording information was actually poor. Sometimes what we found was that action had been taken but not recorded, and no one knew that action had been taken. Sometimes it appeared that action had been taken and it hadn't. And very often what you get, we saw in a couple of pieces of research, that you have entries in files like no concerns, no further action, and that would be the entry. And that doesn't tell anyone about the reason for the visit, the reason for deciding that they didn't need to see the person again, the reason that they didn't want to see the child, the reason they didn't speak to another professional. I think the cultural differences between agencies and professionals I've talked about earlier, and really the importance of chronologies cannot be highlighted enough. We've got now the SWEA guidance on chronologies, which is actually a really good document. That's 2010. And I think that basically what we need to do is ensure that we follow that guidance. But I suppose knowing what's happened in England with the Common Assessment Framework and the fact that people feel almost slaves to their computers and to filling in data, whilst we need to keep these chronologies up to date, it can't be to the detriment of direct work. So I've talked before about Eileen Munro's issue about willingness to interpret initial judgments and interpret new evidence. I think, looking at the third point, we do need to consider, we're moving towards having a shared assessment framework with all the problems that might entail in terms of, as I said, people being more concerned about filling in the forms rather than actual direct work. But I think it is important that we do have a central point where all records of meeting a child and parents are recorded. And really, very basically, in terms of shared working, what we found in two pieces of the empirical research, we found that very basic practices like going on joint visits, completing a joint report, producing documents and protocols between, for example, health and social work, actually did result in people understanding each other's different perspectives and also in terms of sharing records and sharing information.
Okay, in terms of involving children in child protection practice, there are broader requirements under the Children Scotland Act, the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, and the Framework for Standards. But the research also suggests there's clear benefits to including children around their social, psychological, and broader development. But it also suggests there are gaps in engaging with children in the child protection process. Pam has mentioned some of them. And the identification in the literature that engaging with children in child protection is a key protective factor. So in inquiries into child deaths and serious injuries, for example, the Victoria Columbia inquiry, a key factor was a lack of engagement with Victoria about what was going on for her in her life and her understanding of her situation. But another of the findings of the inquiry reports is that practitioners have a tendency only to take on board the child's view if it agrees with their initial assessment. So coming back to that point that Pam was making, around the initial framing of cases, really important to question assessments in the light of new information, in particular engaging with children's perspectives on their situation and questioning initial framing of cases in the light of that. Now, it needs to be acknowledged that there are several barriers to children's participation. One is around the status of children in society as a governed group, but also particularly children who are in receipt of child protection interventions generally tend to be more excluded than children on average. And there might be attitudes around their lack of ability to engage and participate, coming from broader society, coming from professionals, maybe coming from the children and young people themselves. The research does suggest that professionals tend to underestimate the age and extent to which children can participate. And research on young people that have grown up, of their memories of not being included in decisions that had a significant effect on them and their understanding of professional intervention. Also necessary to recognise that the child protection process in the UK tends to be quite an adversarial one, mainly focused around establishing abuse and who the perpetrator was in cases of abuse. And that doesn't always lend itself very easily to involving children. And particularly practitioners in the research and on an anecdotal level talk about tricky situations where a child's view of what they want to happen in child protection processes conflicts with the assessment of what's in their best interest. And that leads to some really, really difficult practice situations for practitioners in child protection. But an important finding from the research is that children, even where the outcome of a decision is not one that they agree with, that they still remember and value having their views taken seriously and having them treated with respect. So in terms of supporting good practice, many of the things that children value in professionals won't be a revelation to the audience in terms of they value staff that are friendly, that can engage with them, that treat them with respect and listen to their views, and can also, so far as possible, respect their confidentiality and treat the information they give with respect and treat it as confidential as they can within the bounds of child protection procedures. It needs to be acknowledged that one of the difficulties around child protection meetings, that these are meetings generally for adults. They are not child-centred meetings. They tend to be ones that Anne Hollow has described, where the child is the object rather than the subject of the meeting. And that might be inevitable, but it's important to recognise that and to recognise that they are adult meetings about children rather than child-centred meetings. And one of the ways of recognising that has been to look at different ways of getting children's input into those adult meetings. So one has been around computer-aided self-interviewing. Commonly in Scotland, Viewpoint has been the tool that's been used, which is basically a programme on a laptop where the computer speaks the questions and the child fills out the responses. Now, the problem with Viewpoint, or the potential problem, is that the evaluations of it tend to be by the organisations that have developed the software, and there's a lack of independent evaluation of that tool. One of the authorities that we spoke to as part of the research is currently conducting its own review, and it's come up with mixed results. And what it found is, yes, it can be a tool for engaging with children and getting their views, but it can also be a barrier if used in the wrong way. And both computer-aided self-interviewing and other forms of new technology in child protection practice, so the use of audio, the use of visual, several things that the people in childhood studies as research techniques for engaging children can be used by practitioners. But it's important to remember that they're a tool to an end, and they don't really take away the responsibility from the practitioner of needing to engage with children. So they're a tool to an end, not an end in itself. The next two points are bits where the research has some conflicts within it. So some of the research suggests that whoever a child trusts, whether it be extended family, friends of the family, should be used to support and advocate for them. And indeed, there's examples in Scotland of peer support for children going to secondary school where an older pupil mentors and supports a younger pupil, and those have been evaluated very successfully in some examples. So there's some evidence that that can work and that children can more easily speak to people of their own age, for example. However, there's other evidence that suggests, particularly child protection workers have questioned the appropriateness of non-formal people, so extended family and friends, fulfilling that role for children in the child protection process. partly because of the issues around safeguarding and whether they're properly addressed, but also around issues of confidentiality. So HMIE itself has raised the issue about the routine availability of independent child advocacy workers. Now, in Scotland, the provision of them is patchy. Children First are most closely associated with them in Scotland, and they run two projects, one in North Ayrshire and one in Moray in the northeast of Scotland, which they're developing. And the project in North Ayrshire works that every child on the child protection register over 8 is allocated a child advocacy worker at the point that their name is placed on the register. And that has been positively evaluated both by HMIE and the Social Work Inspection Agency as an example of good practice. One of the issues around children being on the register that research has highlighted and child advocacy might address is children's lack of knowledge about the child protection process. So one recent piece of research by a group of educational psychologists in Scotland looked at children's views of child protection interventions. And there was 11 children aged between 11 and 18. And they contacted them. And one of the most interesting findings of the research is that when the researchers contacted the children who were either still on the child protection register or whose names had been, the majority of them didn't even know that their names had been on the register. So a real problem with a flow of information to children, and that leads to fears for children when they first become involved in the child protection process. So child advocacy can be one route of addressing that. However, the research also highlights that where child advocates are involved, it's really important to have clarity of the role. Are they there to merely represent what the child is saying at more formal forums, to speak for the child, to maybe address welfare concerns which the child isn't themselves raising? Are they there to raise complaints? So there's real need to clarify the role for child advocacy workers at the outset for the child, the advocacy worker themselves, and the other child protection workers for that service to work as meaningfully as it can do. The other way in which people have talked about children's involvement in child protection is around the broader development of services, so giving feedback on service provision, not just being passive recipients of it. And I'll come back to this in our concluding comments, but just to say that there is a lot of emphasis on involving children, involving service users, and the important thing is that it doesn't lapse into tokenism, that it's probably worse to make a show of engaging children and then not follow through in that in terms of service development and service delivery. Okay, interventions where children have experienced significant harm. So it could be where they're still living with their parents or where they've been placed in substitute care. And one of the main findings is that there's no evidence that one particular intervention, either with parents or children, is the most effective. There's no silver bullet for either working with children or with parents. No one solution. What the research does suggest is that the quality of the relationship between the worker and the parents and or child is key. And that's not to say that the intervention doesn't matter. I've sometimes seen that interpretation of the evidence. I don't think it lends itself to that. The intervention does matter, but for any intervention to be successful, there needs to be a quality of relationship in terms of either moving children or parents on. Now, in terms of the research around parents, parenting programs, parenting groups, are one of the most common forms of intervention where there are concerns. And in different situations, they can be more or less effective. So in situations where there are established specific concerns which parents acknowledge and there's a high motivation to engage with work around those concerns, there is evidence that they are successful. More limited evidence for their success where the concerns are broader and they're not acknowledged by the parents specifically. And very little evidence around the success of parenting programs where parents have committed sexual abuse, probably because the focus there is on the non-abusing parent and work with a child. So depends on the issue according to whether parenting programs work or not. There is, however, substantial evidence that home visiting programs are more effective for preschool children in quote-unquote hard-to-reach families. So the evidence shows marginal improvement for families generally, but where there are specific concerns and families aren't engaging with services, home visiting programs can be particularly effective. Now, in terms of children, cognitive behavioural therapy, is, as with adults, has been one method that's been shown to have good results. And in particular where children experience neglect or abuse, trauma therapy perspectives, that's to say perspectives which acknowledge that in a lot of cases children haven't had chance to process what's happened to them. And the idea of the intervention is to create a safe environment where the child feels safe and can process psychologically and emotionally what has happened to them, and particularly address unfounded associations they might have made, typically that they are to blame for the abuse or they are to blame for being in care. So that's been one method that's been shown to be successful in certain, certain circumstances. One of the real thing that stands out from the literature around children where they've experienced significant harm is around re-abuse rates. Now, one large-scale study has shown that where children are placed in substitute care and then returned to their birth parents after, the re-abuse rates where they're subject to more abuse or more neglect can be as high as 50% of those children returning. And indeed, in some issues of parental substance misuse, they're even higher. So it really brings a focus on those decisions. And indeed, if we look at the history of child protection and the high-profile cases that usually get the media attention, the first child protection tragedy the media picked up on was Maria Colwell in 1973. That was a case where Maria was living with extended family and returned to her birth mother and stepfather and was subsequently subject to abuse and died as a result of it. And the last most high-profile case, Peter Connolly, was again a child who was accommodated in foster care and then returned to his mother's care. So it has become a focus in terms of individual cases, but also the research that suggests this is a fairly widespread phenomenon. Now, that might lead to a conclusion that social workers shouldn't be returning children in those circumstances. And in some cases, some of the ones that I've just mentioned, that might indeed be the case. But in others, what it focuses attention on is the need, again, for assessment. So looking at chronologies with parents, the history of response to professional assessment, and also assessing parenting capacity. And one of the key findings that's coming out is the need not just to concentrate on assessing parenting capacity through what parents say about their parenting. So quite often in social work, there is a traditional interview between a worker and a parent, as Pam was saying, engaging with the parents. And the research is highlighting the need to at least combine that with observations of parent-child interaction, and then that be a substantial part of the assessment of parenting capacity. The need for targeting work with parents, to some extent I've covered, but just the idea that the intervention needs to fit the issues and the kind of the response of the parents to professional intervention. So, for example, a parent where there's issues of long-term neglect, who's not engaging with services and is a quote-unquote hard-to-reach parent, it is unlikely that they're going to engage with a parenting program. And indeed, the effectiveness of parenting programs is undermined by high dropout rates. So really need to think about what the most appropriate intervention for these parents are. In terms of work with children, as I said, not one particular intervention that is the answer, but characteristics of interventions. Perhaps the most important is working with where the child is. So studies of foster care over a number of years, looking at what foster carers did that was successful. And one of the things was allowing the child to perhaps operate at younger developmental age, to play with toys that weren't age appropriate, to act out behaviours. And to be there and to provide a safe environment, but to work with where the child was as and when they wanted to process the events. Other kind of characteristics of interventions have been shown to be successful in terms of relationships that build trust between carers and workers, allowing children to explore emotions, particularly countering misconceptions about what's happened to them in their past, exploring future protective strategies for them. And finally, one of the things coming out of the research literature is the importance of education. There's been focus on education in terms of poor educational outcomes for children at risk in the community with their parents, but also looked after and accommodated children. But one of the more recent findings is that where children who have experienced significant harm have tailored educational plans, it supports their placement stability. So not only does it have good outcomes in terms of educational attainment, but it actually supports their wider well-being and their wider stability within their placement. Okay, finally coming on to kinship care. First of all, to recognise that kinship care has an important role as a placement option, there's been increasing use of it, and indeed increasing government encouragement to use it. And about 20% of substitute care placements are now kinship care placements in Scotland, and a slightly higher proportion, I think, in England. A part of that is coming from the fact that there's a lack of foster placements. That is certainly one factor. But it's also recognising that kinship care can provide a viable alternative, and it also allows for continuity of relationships for children. They're staying with people they already know. They can have more frequent contact with their birth families, and kinship care has been shown to, in general, produce more contact with birth family members. However, important to note that the research evidence does not show that kinship care placements will generally lead to better overall outcomes for children than unrelated foster care, either in children's development or in terms of their placement stability. So it's important to bear in mind that. There is no sense in making a kinship care placement just because it's available. It needs to be the right placement for the child. The research also highlights the gaps in effective assessment and support to kinship care placements. Assessment I'll come on to in just a second, but there is more of a tendency with kinship care placements, the research suggests, for childcare professionals to leave the family to get on with it themselves. Perhaps out of the belief that they can manage it, perhaps also out of the belief that there's need for less structured intervention. Fewer requirements for workers, for example, to supervise contact in kinship care. And that can lead to problems, that assumption, and put pressure on the placement unnecessarily. So in terms of supporting good practice, the first thing is that there should be routine consideration of the possibility of kinship care as a placement option. The research shows that the majority of kinship care placements are initiated by family members, birth family members or extended family members. Very few are initiated by childcare professionals, social workers, actively looking out extended family members. So there needs to be routine consideration of whether a kinship placement is a viable option for a child coming into the care system. Indeed, Scottish Government guidance suggests that there should be a family group conference, a conference which is led by the family, facilitated by a professional, which comes up with a plan for that child and a contingency arrangement if that plan breaks down. And that should happen, and ordinarily that will generate consideration of whether kinship care is an option in the life of that child, in the case of that child. Also, local authorities need to develop clear strategies for working with kinship carers. In terms of interventions, firstly, there needs to be an intervention. Kinship carers can't be left just to get on with it. Otherwise, the outcomes for the children will be poorer, and there's a greater likelihood that the placement will break down. But there also needs to be acknowledged that kinship care placements are not the same as foster placements. That's to say that the research has identified that several kinship carers who wouldn't have been approved as foster carers due to criminal convictions, obviously not in respect of children, but criminal convictions, health, age reasons. They wouldn't have been approved as foster carers. Nonetheless, they provided high-quality care to the family members for whom they cared. So there needs to be an acknowledgement that kinship care is not foster care. And in terms of assessment, some concern that there's a great variety of practice, both between local authorities and within local authorities, about how they assess kinship carers. So some authorities make kinship carers go through a full fostering assessment. Some have an adapted assessment for kinship carers. Some just do a basic police check. And indeed, some of the research suggested that after 2 years after children were sometimes placed in kinship care, there was no assessment of the kinship carers at all. And Allgate and McIntosh, who in 2006 undertook the largest study of kinship care in Scotland, proposed a two-stage model for kinship care. The first is where the basic checks and safeguarding checks are undertaken to ensure that the children are going to be safe in the immediate. And the second stage is then a wider assessment of the appropriateness of that placement for its likely duration. And the thinking behind that is that in many cases, despite the best efforts of practitioners, that children come into care very, very quickly on an immediate basis. And whilst in foster carers will already have been approved, in kinship care, quite often, kinship carers won't have been through that assessment process. So there's a need to recognise that workers need to move quickly in initially assessing kinship placements. Thereafter, they need to look, if the child is going to stay there for a period of time, at doing a more thorough and in-depth assessment. Finally, considerations of permanence. And again, coming back to Allgate and McIntosh, There is an issue where children are staying in kinship care longer term, particularly because it might have financial implications for the kinship carers. They might not be entitled to the same allowances. And one of the findings from the research is that practitioners need to be upfront and honest with kinship carers about that possibility, so they don't feel let down having taken, for example, a residence order and then found that they're not entitled to financial support. But Allgate and McIntosh also question, I think quite legitimately, the practice that sometimes occurred where children were kept on supervision orders through the children's hearing system in order that the local authority could provide them with financial support. So what they say is the local authority, if the kinship carers are in financial need, need to find alternative strategies that still safeguards the permanence for the children in those placements, but provides appropriate financial support to the carers.
We'll be coming to the conclusion now, and this is the penultimate slide. This is from Brandon et al. Marion Brandon and her colleagues did a series of analyses of serious case reviews in England. And I think the most important thing about, one of the most important things about their finding is that, as they say, that the in terms of the serious case reviews that they looked at, most of the cases that they saw weren't labelled as child protection. Most of the children were not on the child protection register. Most of the children had not been to a child protection case conference. Most of the children were being serviced by a social worker as a child in need, or indeed didn't have social work services at all. So I think it's really important that we see what they call safeguarding in England, or in Scotland we still use the term protecting children. We see that as a continuum. Those of you who are students who are out on placement, go to see a family, do an assessment of a child in need. There is no reason to suggest that that child might also not be in need of being safeguarded or protected. And the analysis of serious case reviews shows that most of the children were not regarded as in need of protection. So what I think is really important in terms of social work students and social workers and health workers and teachers, and I think that there's a lot that teachers could be doing and should be doing, is that we don't see child protection as a sphere of activity which you engage in after you've, you know, been qualified for a year and gone on a 2-day training course. Actually, child protection is about everyone's job.
Okay, and another quotation just to finish off. This is taken from a research study that was undertaken for the Scottish Government about children being consulted about government processes, but I think it equally applies to child protection. And what it says is that most young people experience consultation as tokenistic, dominating and useless. And it's very valuable to consult well, but consulting poorly is actually worse than not consulting at all. And that has actually relevance in terms of taking on board children's perspectives for service delivery and service development, but also in terms of the day-to-day practice of social work. There may be cases, as I was saying earlier, where what practitioners do is not what a child wants, and very legitimate circumstances in which that is the case. But practitioners need to be upfront about that with a child or young person, but also still treat their views with respect. And if they don't, then it leads to cynicism and frustration. So the importance of doing that is really underlined. Thank you.